The Holy Gospel according to St. Mark, the 7th chapter. From there, Jesus set out and went away to the region of Tyre. He entered a house and did not want anyone to know he was there, yet he could not escape notice. But a woman whose little daughter had an unclean spirit immediately heard about him, and she came and bowed down at his feet. Now the woman was a Gentile of Syrophoenician origin. She begged him to cast the demon out of her daughter. He said to her, "Let the children be fed first, for it is not fair to take the children's food and throw it to the dogs." But she answered him, "Sir, even the dogs under the table eat the children's crumbs." Then he said to her, "For saying that, you may go. The demon has left your daughter." So she went home, found the child laying on the bed, and the demon gone. Then Jesus returned from the region of Tyre and went by way of Sidon towards the Sea of Galilee in the region of the Decapolis. They brought to him a deaf man who had an impediment in his speech, and they begged him to lay his hand on him. He took him aside in private, away from the crowd, and put his fingers into his ears, and he spat and touched his tongue. Then looking up to heaven, he sighed and said to him, "Ephphatha," that is, "be opened." And immediately his ears were opened, his tongue was released, and he spoke plainly. Then Jesus ordered them to tell no one. But the more he ordered them, the more zealously they proclaimed it. They were astounded beyond measure, saying, "He has done everything well. He even makes the deaf to hear and the mute to speak." The Gospel of the Lord.
Praise to you,
Christ. It is part of our gospel ministry of this congregation to strive to get at the root of the many topics and the many issues that we face each and every day in our lives. By going to the root, by searching out what is behind each and every one of those issues, we can then cast a vision for what is good, what is beneficial. And in casting that vision, we can name those values and those practices that benefit and strengthen one another. And so our witness is to start a conversation on each and every one of these topics, to start a conversation as we are today on education, with the hope that it is your gospel witness, your mission throughout the week as those who are evangelists to continue the conversation. This is a practice we put into place last fall when we became aware that three men in the Lancaster County prison had committed suicide. While there were many approaches that people in the community had taken to speak to that issue, our approach was to call for a public conversation. And I must confess to you that as part of that public conversation, I had my heart touched, I had my mind opened, and I learned about where people are and what they're experiencing in their lives. It was our hope that by identifying the value of human life, the dignity of human life, and our need to preserve that life, that we also need to be active and present in those people who threaten to take their own lives. As So I found my heart singing yesterday whenever I opened the Saturday newspaper. Now, what gave me joy was not the reality that another man tried to take his life at the county jail. But what gave me joy was to read what happened when this man tried to take his life. Three other inmates, witnessing what was happening, ran to his rescue. And they lifted this man up so his weight was not tightening the noose around his neck. And a prison guard came and cut the towel, and they saved the man's life. In that moment, those four men came to themselves. And they had a vision larger than themselves, and values more significant than self-preservation. And they made a difference. This notion of coming to oneself is not an uncommon notion throughout Scripture. That people realizing where they are and what is facing them in their lives come to themselves. It's what happens in the story of the prodigal son, where the younger son goes to his father and he demands of his father his share of the inheritance. He is sending two messages to his father at that point. The first message is that to me, you're dead. Because if you are to collect your inheritance, it is usually because the person has died. The second message is, I am not concerned about your well-being in that I'm taking these resources from you. And this son, self-serving in his own ways, took that money, and we hear that he squandered it in dissolute living. I love that phrase. Now, it never explains to us what dissolute living is. We all have impressions of what dissolute living is, and usually those impressions are rooted in what we see other people doing wrong. It's really easy to point out the dissolute living in the lives of other people, but perhaps it's never described because we are to explore in our own lives how we are squandering our own wealth and our own blessings in our own living that dissolves our dignity. The money is gone. The young man is led to feeding swine, an abomination in that culture. He's tempted to eat the food of those swine. And at that moment, we hear in Scripture, he came to himself. That doesn't mean that he went back to his old way of being, but he went back and he threw himself at the mercy of his Father. And in doing that, he had a vision of something larger than what life had been before. He came to himself. The Latin word for coming back to oneself is educare, which is the root for our word education. To be brought back to oneself. And as we begin this conversation on the issue of public education, I would like to put forward that as the root and the purpose of education, to be brought back to ourselves. A few weeks back, Supreme Court Justice retired Sandra Day O'Connor was testifying before a committee of the Senate, and she shared the witness that she had made in her own observations of public school system, whereas a number of years ago we saw that our students had lower scores in math and sciences than students of other nations. And what that has led us to do is to focus extraordinary amounts of time and energy and resources on math and science education. She also then has observed that it has meant the diminishing of covering of issues related to civics in education. And so she is proposing alternatives to teach civics in public schools. Now, civics is more than simply understanding the political system and being able to name all the pieces of the government. Civics is rooted in the word civil, in the word civilization. It's at the core of who we are and how we live together as a community of people. It's about how we make decisions in our own daily living that are beneficial to the larger community. It is about a personal maturity that leads us to see something larger than our own self-serving motives. It is perhaps about being brought back to oneself. The honor, the integrity, the dignity for which we were all intended. I would like us to then consider, in reflection and for conversation, how education can serve its purpose of bringing one back to oneself. I think, first of all, it's rooted in the actual phrase public education. Now, when we use the phrase public education now, it usually boils down to money. There are the public schools and there are the private schools. And how is it that we can make sure that some money from the public schools pay for people to go to private schools? I think we lose the understanding of what public means. Public education means it is an institution that belongs to all of us, to which we are all responsible as members of this society. Elizabeth Ochtemeyer, New Testament scholar, defines righteousness in this way: fulfilling the obligations one has to one's relationships. We have, as citizens of this nation, an obligation to the institution we call public education. Whether you have children in school or whether you do not, it is an obligation that is borne by all of us. In public education, there is a strong need for consistency and accountability. You will hear people who will make this statement: back when I was a kid, which is always a warning sign as soon as someone starts telling you that, because usually it's filtered through their life experiences. Back when I was a kid, if I got in trouble in school, it would be worse at home. Now, it's immature of us and narrow-minded of us to think if we just went back to the way we used to do things, everything would be okay. And in doing that, we miss the point, which is that there was consistency between the classroom and the home. Likewise, related to accountability, I can remember the moment. I was in senior high school and I was in the line at the local grocery store with my mother, who was an elementary instrumental music teacher. And as we're standing in line, this gentleman comes up and says, "Dear Mrs. Menser, aren't you?" And she looks and says, "Yes." He goes, "You don't know who I am." And she says, "No, I don't recognize you." And he said, he gave his name and he said, "You still don't remember?" "No, I don't." He said, "I was the first student you ever paddled when you became a teacher." He told the story of how he came into music class that day, and there was this new young female teacher in a class that he couldn't tolerate, and so he decided he would see how far he could push her. He acted out once. My mother said, "You get 3 chances, and after that, you will deal with the consequences." Well, he used up his 3 strikes quickly, he says, and at that moment, my mother grabbed him by the back of the neck. She dragged him out in the hallway, and she administered his discipline. She was horrified as he told that story in that line of the grocery store. The rest of the people didn't mind waiting long to check out because they were having great fun with this story. And once again, in an immature and narrow-minded way, we could say if we just brought that kind of punishment back to school, everything would be okay, and once again, we would miss the point. It's not about that particular technique, but it's about accountability. Consistency and accountability. If you have a school where 2 out of 5 teachers insist that their students are seated at their desk when the bell rings, and another 3 teachers do not, the students will not live up to those expectations. If you have a place where 3 teachers insist that the homework be turned in on time each and every time, and 2 other teachers keep giving extensions, the students will not turn their homework in on time. It is a consistency across the board, teacher to teacher, principal to teacher, administrator to teacher, parent to child, parent to teacher, a consistency that brings about that accountability. It was a couple years back that Pastor Sadie shared one of her many words of wisdom with me. She doesn't even remember that because everything she says is wise, so she doesn't remember when this one thing. But we were talking about parenting techniques. You know, and asking the question whether it was the sort of the laissez-faire, backed-off technique or the heavy-handed, strong parenting technique that made the difference. And this is the observation she made. It wasn't the technique. It was the consistency from parent to parent. If both parents parented the same way, the child was stronger. The consistency that makes the difference. Bryson Freeman, an internationally known physicist, spoke at the Chautauqua Institute a few weeks back, and he spoke of a conversation he had with the man who was assigned the task of determining why the space shuttle Challenger exploded. He said that he went and he first talked to the engineers who were hands-on, intimately involved with the program, and he asked the engineers, before you went into this program, what were the chances you believed that the Challenger would explode? And the engineers said, 1 in 100. He then went and interviewed the management, less involved, less connected with the project, ask them the same question. What did you believe the chances were that this shuttle would explode? They answered 1 in 100,000. Notice the disconnect between those who were intimately involved, hands-on, and those who had oversight. I do not think that our schools will benefit by oversight from federal or state government. But the most creativity, the most chance for growth, the most opportunity to take risks to grow can happen at the grassroots level in each classroom, in each school, taking into consideration the students and the population and the needs. And the need for the stress on communication, both written and oral communication. The story of a third grade teacher who had been working with her students in writing sentences and paragraphs, and it was time for them to write a short story. So she told them all to sit at their desk and to write a 3-paragraph story. And then she went to sit at her desk while they had 20 minutes to write the story. Well, one little boy was done within seconds after the assignment was given. And she said, "You need to be working on your story." And he said, "I'm done." And she brought him up to the desk and she looked at his paper and she read his story. The man proposed to the woman. She said no. They lived happily ever after. There is a need for us to develop our communication, the way that we write, the way that we communicate with each other. But that need also moves beyond the written form to the oral form. The capacity for people to speak intelligently with each other face to face. Because when you're working with your ability to speak, you're also working with your ability to listen. And perhaps if we spent more time in oral communication, we would become better listeners to those who speak when we're in their presence. And there are some whose strongest gift is speaking and not in writing. I share that as my own personal witness. People keep saying, "We think it's wonderful that you never use notes for your sermons." But I have to admit, it's because the thought of sitting down and writing my sermon is so overwhelming, I don't do it. I work it out up here. To take into consideration that the models of education that we have are also based on an agrarian and industrial model. One of our local superintendents, when I interviewed her in preparation for this series, pointed it out to me that our annual schedule of school rotates around the harvest schedule, ending in late spring, starting in the fall. And that the sense of moving from one subject to another is based on the assembly line, where you start with the empty chassis and you end up with a full car by the end. What does it mean in an age of technology and in an age when we are just exploring this vast domain called neuroscience and how the brain works? Notice that none of these things that I just mentioned cost any money. There's no expense involved in new ways of thinking. There's a young man traveling on business, and he pulled into a hotel for the night, tired from his travels, and he went to the front desk, and the person behind the front desk said, "I'm sorry, I don't have any rooms for you tonight." And he says, "Are you sure there's not even one room?" And the person behind the desk said, "Well, there is one room, but it's above the room of another man who's here regularly, and the man on the first floor, he doesn't like any sounds. It keeps him awake at night. And I'm not sure I want to rent that to you." Well, the young man promised that he would be completely silent and not disturb the man below him. So he got the room. He goes into his room. He sits on his bed. He takes off his first shoe and he drops it on the floor with a thud. And then all of a sudden he goes, "Oh," and realizes he was supposed to be quiet. So as he removes his second shoe, he carefully and gently places it on the floor. About 2 minutes later, there's a knock at the door. He opens the door. The man introduces himself as the guy in the room below and says, "Would you please drop the other shoe so I can go to sleep?" We live in an age of worrying about the other shoe dropping. That at any moment, everything is going to collapse around us. Look at the fall lineup on television if you don't believe that's the theme of our human lives. Anytime a society is overwhelmed with anxiety and fear, it will attack the institutions that bring about maturity among its people. Anytime we are overwhelmed with anxiety, we will attack the institutions that bring maturity among our people. And schools are those institutions that create the possibility for maturity, and so they stand under attack. We have made radical shifts in education out of fear. An article in Fortune magazine this past week talking about the increasing gap between the rich and the poor, how the middle class in part has moved up to the upper middle class, but there's a whole group that's being left behind, and this was the solution they're proposing to solve the problem: education reform. Do we need to attack these institutions because we're afraid? Be strong. Do not fear. For the eyes of the blind shall be opened, the ears of the deaf shall be unstopped, the lame shall leap like a deer, the tongue of the speechless shall sing for joy, for waters will break forth in the wilderness, streams in the desert, the burning sand shall become a pool, and the thirsty ground springs of water. This, brothers and sisters, is the word of the Lord. Amen.